Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Decouple Podcast, where we explore the science and technologies that can decouple human well-being from its ecological impacts, and the politics that can make decoupling possible. Welcome back to Decouple. Today, I'm joined by Dietmar Dennering and Izuru Senavaradni to talk about the recent closure of Indian Point Nuclear Station. After a childhood on a dairy farm in Germany, Dietmar earned a PhD in political science at Munster University and went on to build an online publishing platform called EventMe, Inc. Dietmar has been a lifelong environmentalist and began focusing on nuclear energy advocacy in 2018. Izuru is an energy and climate professional with 17 years working in investment diligence, policy advocacy, and sustainable business development. Izuru founded Radiant Value Management in 2015 and previously oversaw the energy and resource portfolio of Equinox Partners in New York City. Welcome, Dietmar and Izuru, to Decouple. It's great to have you.
Thank you for having us, Chris.
So as you guys know from probably listening to a few shows before, I know I regularly spam your Facebook page with every episode I publish. I tend to like to get the formalities out of the way and get to know my guests a little bit more on a human level. So maybe take, you know, a minute or two just to tell me a little bit about yourselves, maybe where your values come from and how you came to be passionate around campaigning for Indian Point.
So I would like to be a little bit more specific of what that means to be a lifelong environmentalist. In Germany in the 80s, that meant you joined the Green Party. That's what I've done. And I was interested in many fields. Energy policy was not necessarily one of them. And I've never been anti-nuclear. And that was not really an issue. I didn't bump into anyone that I had to fight on the stand. But the entire party, of course, was anti-nuclear. And then eventually I left the party and left Germany and came to the US. And in 2011 or so, when Fukushima happened and the Germany went straight out of nuclear energy after a lot of back and forth, but this seemed very final. I was thinking to myself, well, with global warming, can we really do it without nuclear? And over the next years, I realized, well, if I do something again in advocacy or volunteer work, I need to focus on this. And so I stumbled into Indian Point debate, stand up for nuclear, and now we're here. Yeah, we came a little late, most of us, to this fight.
I hear you. I have a similar experience up here in Canada. We've been looking at one of our three major nuclear plants is scheduled to close in 2024, 2025. It actually had its license hearing. There was an extension that was granted, but you know, I kick myself. I'm like, if we'd been around 10 years ago, we could have maybe made a big impact. But as things are standing, a refurbishment has not been organized, and we're looking at losing, you know, 20% of our nuclear energy, which is a huge chunk of our clean energy, and it's going to set us backwards a long ways, moving in the wrong direction. Okay, Izuru, you're next.
Sure, yeah. I grew up in Sri Lanka. I have been, climate concerned, but I've been an energy investor. So I've been getting more as an energy investor, in reconciling that with my environmentalist or climate concerns. I mean, what made me realize is, you know, there's billions of people in the world that don't have adequate energy access. And what that means for human life index or human development in general. You know, I've been an advocate for climate policy for about 5 or 6 years. When I launched my own investment fund, I was able to explore clean technologies, clean energy sources. I've been getting more and more learning as I learn more about the energy systems. The necessity of nuclear has become more and more abundant. And I see no choice. I work with about 12 different groups on different climate issues. And nuclear York is one of them.
Great. So guys, I know this is a dark day. It's been a dark week, I should say. You know, I want to give you guys some space to, I guess, kind of grieve in that regard. But I have to say, you know, I've been doing a lot of reflecting on nuclear advocacy and sort of the progression of kind of where the movement has gone. And, you know, the way I understand it, or have come to understand it from the brief time I've been involved, is that, you know, things kind of started out with a few visionaries who made the environmental case for nuclear energy. And as far as I can tell, I mean, that was happening back in Ansel Adams' day, early days of the Sierra Club. Unfortunately, they took a turn in the other direction, but other figures like James Lovelock, the great English scientist and inventor, you know, moving on to Stuart Brand, you know, prominent environmentalists like Mark Linus and Ted Nordhaus and Michael Schellenberger over the years. So kind of, to me, it sort of started out with these individuals that became sort of thought leaders. And then that morphed into a second stage, which I think is kind of like a think tank stage with organizations like Breakthrough and EP. But what I'm really excited about now is seeing a real sense of kind of grassroots movement building. So beyond the think tank, starting to see organizations like Stand Up for Nuclear or Mothers for Nuclear, or indeed Nuclear New York. And in terms of where we're at now, it seems that, you know, in this little stages that I'm building, we're kind of in the stage four of these campaigns to save existing nuclear. Hopefully this will be our last loss, and lessons learned from partially from your guys' campaigning will help us with saving other places like Diablo Canyon, but also, you know, heading into stage five, which I see as kind of advocacy for new things happening, new builds like a campaign for a green nuclear deal. So I'm kind of doing this overview and summary of what I see happening. And I really want to, you know, in preparing for this interview, it's been really awesome sort of seeing all of the efforts that you guys put in, how well organized they were, how you guys got into the media, the arguments you're able to make. Even you guys had a light projection show that I think you did a couple weeks ago, bringing attention to the issue. So really excited to talk to you guys about and learn lessons from this struggle that you guys have been engaged in.
Okay.
So with that in mind, let's lay the groundwork. You know, this podcast is downloaded in 90 countries around the world, a lot of listeners in the US, but for those of our listeners that aren't as familiar with the Indian Point story, walk us through a little bit of the history, the contribution of Indian Point, and its relevance to the climate change issue in New York.
Sure, I'll take that. I mean, Indian Point, since the 50s, has been generating about a quarter of downstate New York's electricity. That has actually ramped up over the last decade or two under the ownership of the current owner, or operations has improved substantially. But 80% of downstate New York's carbon-free electricity. So it's as if this like massive energy infrastructure in a population dense area where you don't have the ability to deploy vast amounts of land intensive energy, low carbon energy sources. So it's effectively, it's either Indian Point or fossil. So because Indian Point has been there preventing fossil from being there, it's enabled New York City and downstate New York to breathe cleaner air for half a century, and provide it with carbon-free energy for that long. Mm-hmm. So it's a massive infrastructure, like a fundamental piece of how New York has built itself to be a greater city, from you know, this reliable carbon-free, air pollution-free energy source.
Yes, it's very interesting. I've been reading a lot of Václav Smil's work. He's highly cited by Bill Gates, you know, who reads every one of his books that comes out, a really numerate energy analyst. And I was just looking at, you know, because I'm thinking about New York and such a, you know, population-dense area. And in terms of kind of the history of cities and our relationship with energy, I mean, these large cities are only possible because of energy density. You know, looking at sort of pre-modern cities where you'd need 150 times the land area of the city itself just for the energy needs in terms of cutting down forests to do things like heating or running basic industries. So the idea of kind of taking a step backwards to really dilute energy source just really doesn't make sense in terms of a city like New York. When you talked about it being, it's 80% of clean energy in downstate New York, right? But I think I was seeing that one reactor was the equivalent energy output of all of New York's wind and solar. Is that correct?
So it's actually more than that. So both reactors together produce 2.5 times the electric output of all of wind and all of solar combined in the entire state. So it's like 1.25 or so per reactor of the entire output.
Wow. And I mean, it's been interesting, following this matter on social media and seeing groups like NRDC cheerleading the closure of Indian Point. They said it was an honor to have joined Riverkeeper and others in shutting down the plant. And I mean, just imagining someone going around and ripping down every single wind turbine and solar panel in the state in a morning, and someone cheerleading that is truly extraordinary when you sort of put it in perspective of what has been lost. Now, I mean, New York State has made some pretty ambitious climate goals for itself. I think there's this Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act. Can you tell me a little bit about the political background to all of this, particularly sort of the kind of aspirational goals of New York State as stated?
Well, New York State has a history, or its governors, of making big promises on community protection, yes, and climate protection. And like, it started with Governor Pataki in the early 2000s. He had ambitious renewable goals and failed to deliver. And then he was followed by Spitzer, I believe. And he also upped the ante. And then he was followed by his name, I forgot. And then eventually Cuomo came, and he also failed on the previous promises and made another promise that he would bring renewable to 50% by 2030. And it didn't look like he would achieve doing that. And then he said, oh, we'll bring it to 70% renewable electricity generation by 2030. And that is when we already have about 30% of our electricity come out of hydro. So that is already there. So it's not such a big lift, but we're going to fail that. And I think Cuomo knows that. And so he tops even that by actually bringing the state backwards with a shutting down of Indian Point. But maybe Cyril can explain a little bit more the details of the CLCPA of 2019.
Yeah, so the it's touted as a nation-leading ambition for climate policy. The CLCPA says 70% renewables by 2030 and 40% carbon free by 2040. This has, I mean, as we know, this has not been done at an industrial economy with a population base of this scale. And we talked about the population density issues for downstate New York, which is a further complication thereof. But setting, if you destroyed all the wind turbines and solar panels, which currently, or which used to, so in 2019, of all of New York State, solar plus wind produced contributed to 5% of its electricity generation. This is including rooftop solar, but in downstate New York, it's about 2%. So, and this is after decades of subsidies and incentives to push advance these solar and wind, which I'm a big fan of solar and wind. I'm trying to get my daughter's school to have solar panels on their roof. I can't, unfortunately. I live in a condo building, but that, while we need all that, we need to expand that. That doesn't mean that we should rip out the infrastructure that already exists. That makes zero sense, and we are going back decades.
So in terms of what's happening now, we have these ambitious goals. I mean, talk is very cheap. I think politicians know that. These goals are, frankly preposterous when you look at them and the time schedules involved, and you know, the transmission issues and the grid integration issues. It's pretty stunning what people can get away with in the media in terms of also just kind of the blind acceptance of, you know, these kind of statements. And I think it has a lot to do with, you know, if you raise any concerns or questions about renewable energy, then, you know, people are like, well, what else can we do? You must be a climate denier, not concerned about climate, because nuclear is just not even on the table. It's this kind of, you know, elephant in the background sort of churning away and doing the lion's share of the work and not getting any credit for it. It was interesting to see that New York State did offer zero emissions credits to some of the upstate reactors. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Upstate New York nuclear plants got zero emission credits to make them competitive with fossil combustion. So the backdrop here is that the shale revolution has materially impacted the economics of electricity generation. So over the last 5 years, the price of methane gas, also known as natural gas, has dropped by 2/3 from where it was in the 5 year period before that. And the price of wholesale electricity has also dropped exactly the same amount. So at this point, there's no source of electricity that makes economic sense on its own other than burning methane gas. Upstate nuclear plants did get the zero emission credit to make them survive this onslaught. I mean, in the case of solar and wind, they get multiples of the wholesale electricity price in subsidies, and that's why they come on when they come on. But Indian Point was excluded for political purpose, and it couldn't survive this. It's a loss-making operation, and you can't expect the operator to keep operating it for the benefit of society when they are faced with so many lawsuits and on top of not making money from it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, when these zero emission credits were established, they picked an arbitrary benchmark year, I think 2014 or 15, where Indian Point was actually apparently making money because electricity prices in downstate were traditionally higher than in upstate. So that's why they said, well, the upstate plants would get these zero emission credits and Indian Point will not. And that looked fine at the time, but the zero emission credits were always market defined. So they were always, there is an adjustment regularly to make sure that they are not too high, but also high enough to make sure that these plants are not operating at a loss. They could have done the same thing with Indian Point, but by not listing Indian Point by name, it was excluded at a time when it was pretty obvious already that the shale revolution would continue and would hit Indian Point pretty soon. And then in 2016-17, when this closure agreement was finally settled, there was Entergy, the operator, probably realized there's not going to be money in this for a long time to come with the gas prices where they are and no zero emission credits. And they just folded under the pressure, legal pressure from the nonprofits and from the state as well. They had issues with the getting the water permits for the cooling water from the Hudson River from the state. And they were constantly sued by Riverkeeper and others. And then these fights with the NRC for the license renewable, and it just got too much. And so they were an easy victim and agreed to this closure agreement just to get out of the legal hassle of all this.
Yeah. Entergy is also leaving all deregulated electricity markets. It's not just New York.
Mm. Wow.
And so that's a, yes, obviously the legal battles are causing fatigue, but that doesn't prevent you. I mean, if you have a money-making asset, you will keep fighting for that asset, right?
Mm-hmm.
Oil companies fail so many legal battles in, Shell in Nigeria or whoever, right? But they are not going to just pack up and leave because if that asset made money. But the broken electricity markets when they, we allow, so we are now displacing carbon-free electricity from Indian Point with fossil combustion, one for one. And those fossil combustion pays no cost. There's no cost of containment. There's no cost of cost to society incorporated into that electricity generation.
So as it stands, there's no carbon tax on these natural gas plants.
The RGGI, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, is a northeastern states in the U.S. have this RGGI initiative. Mm-hmm. And that has a carbon price of $6.50 per ton.
Right.
So that equates to about, you know, $3 per megawatt hour.
Okay.
And it's insignificant. It doesn't change anybody's calculus on economic calculation of which plants to bring on or not. So I mean, compare that to, New York State, NYSERDA is trying to bring in offshore wind at $160 per megawatt hour.
Wow.
So wholesale prices are $22 per megawatt hour.
Wow. So let's talk about who wanted Indian Point dead and what their motivations were. You mentioned Riverkeeper. You've mentioned Cuomo a little bit. Let's get a bit political and trace out that history.
There was opposition to Indian Point being built, right? at the very beginning, there were groups fighting it and individuals, and well, Indian Point got built anyway, but it all came down basically to Riverkeeper crystallizing this resistance, if I understand this now, having come late to this fight correctly. For Riverkeeper, the biggest deal was the fish, right? The cooling, the river water would be taken in as for cooling down the steam and then discharged at a much higher temperature. And some life, like microbic life, fish eggs, and maybe the one or the other actual fish would die in this process. The river ecosystem seems to have been doing fine. This is being done by fossil fuel power plants around the world, even on the Hudson River as well. So Indian Point is not unique in this position, but Indian Point does not have a cooling tower or anything like that. So there was pressure by Riverkeeper to get rid of this once through cooling system with the river water. And they brought it, they sued, and eventually they lost it because the consensus was, well, if we build an alternative system, it will cost a lot of money. So the investor, that is the owner of the plant, would need some assurances that the plant has a long life, and nobody wanted to give this. And environmentalists also said that, well, we would have to shut down Indian Point for quite some time in order to build cooling towers or to have like a more beneficial cooling system that uses river water in an indirect system. And during this shutdown, we would have to run fossil fuel plants and people would die out of emissions, particulate emission down here in the city or something like that. So that idea was tabled. And then Riverkeeper didn't give up, right? They aligned themselves with the crazies and with the concern and everybody in between. And they threw everything at Indian Point, like the totally ludicrous and, well, their fish thing. They did realize nobody cares about the fish. So they had to get a little creative there, but they kind of were the unifier, backed up as well with NRDC. And along comes Andrew Cuomo as the Attorney General, who basically backs up this fight of Riverkeeper against the plant and makes Indian Point's life really difficult by constantly threatening or denying them to get this water use license. It's really just heat that they are discharging into the river and the plant depends on it. And that always became a struggle. So then the state and in parts of the city as well intervened in the license renewal process. And I saw one number, it was like $200 million that Entergy had spent on all these lawsuits with the NRDC, with the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, to get the license renewal, and with the DEC, the Department of Environmental Conservation of the state of New York, and then all these lawsuits with Riverkeeper and others. So this made it really, really expensive. And it also, then there was this 50 miles zone debate when Gregory Jaczko, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission chairman at the time of the Fukushima meltdowns, warned all Americans within 50 miles radius to evacuate. Right? This 50 mile number suddenly got, that was wrong anyway, but that then got conflated with a 50 mile food and water watch zone around Indian Point in case of an emergency, and presented as an evacuation zone affecting 20 million people who would be in a life or death situation in case something would happen. And then anything that did happen at Indian Point, whether a transformer blew up or something else, they had to turn down the reactor, or they found pieces to be replaced. Everything was being presented as, oh, New York City just slammed away off a 20 million fatality cliff. And right. It was so close, and everybody is trying to present the shutdown of Indian Point as something that saves the city or something like that. So this is kind of the narrative that has been driven, mm-hmm. but it comes down to a powerful and dedicated organization such as Riverkeeper being concerned about fish.
Yeah, I mean,
it's a backdrop, right? I don't know if this is the right forum to bring this up, but like, you know, like Hitler wouldn't exist if the backdrop wasn't there, right? Like you gotta have this, economic or political backdrop to enable somebody to come in and clinch that leadership, so to speak. In this case, before Cuomo became the governor, the Department of Environmental Conservation had denied Entergy the water discharge permit. And then Cuomo quickly jumped on it. I mean, this was a campaign promise that he made while running for Attorney General, and then subsequent a campaign promise that he made while running for governor. There's political expedience or political, you know, votes that he can get by claiming this celebrity cause.
Mm-hmm. And Cuomo is not anti-nuclear. He was supporting the zero emission credits for the upstate plans, and that sells upstate. Upstate is a little bit more conservative. Right. And people like these power plants there, and they understand there's this clean energy coming out of there and good jobs. And these arguments don't count as much here in downstate, where people are considering themselves progressive and kind of come born with this belief that progressive means you got to be anti-nuclear. And then they fall into this old fight against Indian Point as an environmental cause.
So, I mean, let's talk about that a little bit more. You know, within progressive communities, environmental justice is a term that gets thrown around a lot. And when we talk about the closure of Indian Point and the loss of, you know, this zero emission, zero air pollution source, you know, what's coming to the rescue? You mentioned Azura was a kind of one-to-one replacement with fossil fuels. Talk a little bit about the, you know, what plants are coming online and this Asthma Alley concept. I'm not as familiar with the local geography in New York.
So Cricket Valley is now New York State's largest fossil plant. Cricket Valley turned on a month before Indian Point 2, the reactor that shut last year, shut down. So clearly there's some relationship there. Mm-hmm. CPV Valley, which came on a year before that, there's all sorts of corruption that went into approving that plant, or approving the building of that plant. That plant is now the state's third largest fossil plant, generator, and that came on. The U.S. attorney, I'll get back to that. the connection between India Point's closure and the need for CPV are publicly acknowledged by a US judge. So of the three largest fossil plants, two of them would not have existed had Indian Point being allowed to operate for another 20, 30, 40 years, as other plants of similar caliber, a similar operational excellence, are now allowed to operate in the United States. Mm-hmm.
There was talk about a number of other smaller, older fossil plants that are, I think, closer to densely populated areas, potentially having to fire up as well.
PV and Cricket are a little out of the city, and so they don't harm as many people. The harm is high, but there's not that many people to breathe in those particulate pollution. But they are not enough. So older fossil plants in Metro New York City need to ramp up by about 30% to bridge that gap. This is even with renewables additions coming in as expected or as projected, which we can debate whether those things will happen or not. But the one-to-one replacement comment comes from, like, had Indian Point been allowed to operate, you could bring that all those renewables on and use that renewables to displace fossil generation, especially in these densely populated areas that a lot of poor minority people live in.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the African American Environmentalist Association argued that their quote is, how many African American children should suffer from asthma in order to marginally improve the level of fish egg mortality in the Hudson River?
Wow.
That's
wow.
And this was filed in the NRC, Nuclear Regulatory Commission.
That's an amazing quote. That's an amazing quote. I mean, two issues that come to mind, and I have to credit Meredith Angwin in her excellent book, Shorting the Grid, with bringing these to my attention, because Meredith worked in power plant pollution control. And one of the issues that came up in our discussion in that previous podcast episode I did is that when you have these natural gas plants kind of load following the unpredictable spikes of wind and solar, a lot of the time you just have them sort of, I think it's called on like a hot start, where they're burning fuel just ready to come online. And then they're also rapidly changing their output. And she was telling me that, you know, this can be carefully controlled if you're running them in a more constant manner to reduce nitrous oxide, for instance. But when you're ramping them like this, you can get really unpredictable pollution effects and often burn a lot more fuel. It's kind of analogous to highway driving versus stop and start driving in the city. So, I mean, that's, I think, another pollution concern. But then the other thing she talks about a lot is that fatal trifecta, which is the pairing of intermittent renewable sources with gas. And I understand that New York has actually got a lot of prohibitions on actually gas pipelines. And we're seeing in areas with higher renewables penetrations like California and Texas, when there is a big strain, as we're expecting more extreme weather as climate change advances, the potential for more grid instability, and really for those who, you know, can't afford a Tesla Powerwall to be the ones who suffer. So there's kind of an environmental justice element, not just to pollution, but also to grid instability, if we think of the grid as a commons.
Yeah, it's really ironic that the state, New York State, as well, like California, are discussing moratoriums on residential gas hookups. Where gas is really a very reliable and affordable heat source for homes, and people like to cook with it as well. But they, at the same time, they allow, like here in New York, giant new gas power plants to be hooked up to the same gas network and to replace nuclear power plant that has been reliably through hot and cold, storm and calm, producing good electricity for the region. And on the backup, we learned a lot about Texas, how unprepared they were for this event in the winter where so many people then died as a consequence. Here in New York, we're a little bit better prepared for a situation like that. And even for gas shortages, we store a lot of oil on site. Many of our gas power plants are actually dual fuel, so they're prepared to be switched to run on oil in case there's a gas shortage, say in winter or in like a crazy summer situation where the power plants need so much gas for electricity generation that even in the summer, the gas pressure is running low. So they run to, they switch to heating oil. And I did some calculation on my neighborhood power plant, which is Ravenswood Generating Station, which is by capacity the biggest power plant, fossil power plant here in the state. And we celebrate Ravenswood with news about a giant battery that they are trying to establish there. I love batteries. They will do a lot to prevent this kind of hot idle, hot standby of these peaker units because they kind of help even out load and supply of electricity. But that battery itself will have a capacity of, I believe it's 2.4 or 2.5 gigawatt hours. Maybe it will only be built out for now to 1.2 gigawatt hours. So about 50 or 100% of Indian Point's output for 1 hour, and they can run that over about 8 hours. So it's a really big battery, but the real backup at Ravenswood is 100,000 barrels of oil that they keep on site, half of it in barge and the rest of it distributed on three giant tanks that are standing on the property. And the energy stored in these huge tanks is sufficient to produce about 75 gigawatt hours of electricity. Oil is our backup, not these batteries.
Minutes, like how many minutes can you store on the battery and how many minutes worth of electricity do you store in the oil tanks?
Yeah, so if you run the entire power plant, the 2.5 gigawatts at Ravenswood on oil only, you would get to 30 hours, then the tanks are empty. But of course, the barge can be reloaded and they can bring in fresh barges in those 30 hours. The battery to put the same amount of electricity out is empty after 1 hour. Now it has a discharge, maximum discharge that empties it over 8 hours, but then it needs to be recharged. And we don't have wind, we don't have solar or hydro or anything in these situations where we need that battery power to recharge it. No, it will be recharged by some fossil turbine that's recharging it at night when the load is not all of that crazy.
Wow. I mean, that was the thing with Texas, right? I mean, people were saying, oh, we just need to build more batteries, but what do you charge them with? What do you charge them with in a setting where your wind is coming at like a 4% capacity factor and there's no sun? It's wild. And also with the cold, batteries don't seem to work quite as well.
But Texas has a lot of wind, whereas, you know, downstate New York has zero so far.
Mm-hmm. And then there's big plans. I mean, you were mentioning, they're trying to change building code so there won't be gas heating. They're trying to electrify everything as much as possible, transportation. Mm-hmm. So I understand that the requirements for renewable build-out would be something like 30 times what currently exists in New York State. I mean, I don't think that includes intermittency, but basically the take home is that, you know, the plan is to actually require a lot more generation. I had an interesting conversation with a regulatory economist named Edgardo Sepulveda, which was, you know, looking at that era in which we were adding a lot of capacity to the grid. And that really happened within these regulated markets, which rewarded building new generation. But, you know, all that aside, I mean, we're talking about the need for an enormous amount of new electricity, and it really should be zero carbon in the context of closing down, you know, this, you were saying it was twice as large as all of the renewable output in the whole state. So,
well, not all of renewable, all of solar and wind.
Solar and wind, yeah.
So New York State is blessed with a ton of hydro. Niagara actually used to compete with Indian Point at being the biggest energy producer. But hydro is limited. Hydro can't grow because of ecological concerns, but also because of economic concerns, as mentioned before. Solar and wind get these massive amounts of subsidies. Hydro gets nothing except for that you know, immaterial Reggie Price. So I visited a hydro plant about 2 years ago, a permitted, ready to build hydro project, and they couldn't pull the trigger because wholesale electricity prices are so low and they get no credit for their zero carbon output.
Wow.
But we are choosing, I mean, we if you go to this Climate Action Council meetings, there's prejudicial preference for only solar and wind. It's like a blinders on that we can't, we are only solar and wind, we are only solar and wind. And there's no, nobody, seemingly there's nobody to speak up for hydro or nuclear.
So, I mean,
this is at the time when we haven't solved any of the storage issues. Mm-hmm. When that matter comes up, yes, they all agree, yes, we have to also develop or invest in storage. And there's just nothing going on there. It's just like these keywords, phrases that are popular, renewable natural gas or batteries, or I think they don't really want to do pumped storage. That is not a big debate. Some of that will probably come as well. And then we also are making minimal progress on any transmission projects, right? All these things have to come in place when we are adding this much of solar and wind to the grid. And one thing you mentioned that due to beneficial electrification, that the demand is, that the load on the grid is going to increase. And that's kind of a good thing, right? We want that. But the zero emission credits, they're running out in 2029. And the expectation is that without these renewable, these zero emission credits, that the nuclear power plants will fold.
Wow.
Also, with the 70% requirement for renewable electricity on the grid, what is the other 30% going to be? The nuclear plants that we have right now, they're not necessarily a good match to ramp up and down to fill this gap. They're also too small, right? So with it's kind of an ideal situation for those people who hate nuclear that, hey, by 2029, we just shut off nuclear. And in 2030, we have all these gas power plants out there that are filling in the remaining 30%. And then we can have crazy intermittent wind and solar on the grid and fill in the gaps by ramping up and down hydro as much as these rivers can take it, and gas with the rest. And the gas industry supports it because with the demand growing as expected and being fueled by all these ideas, electrifying homes and electrifying traffic, we might actually be burning more gas in electricity generation than we're burning right now. Now tell me, where is climate leadership in here and community protection?
Right. No, I mean, that's always struck me as this, it's kind of an incompatibility between nuclear and renewables at any significant penetration of renewables, because they can come on the market. We have that in Ontario here, where I jokingly say we're the France of North America with about 60% nuclear in our electricity mix. And we tried to become the Germany with our Green Energy Act, where we built a lot of wind turbines and solar, or wind turbines produced completely out of phase with our peak demand. And when they were initially given first access to the grid, we'd have to shut off our nuclear all the time to allow them on. Nuclear would take 3 days to restart. And in the meantime, the wind would die down and we'd have to burn a lot of gas. So I think we ended up saving $200 million worth of natural gas per year by not allowing them onto the grid and curtailing wind. But I think the renewables advocates hate that. They don't like that they can't get on the grid whenever they feel like it, or whenever they get that that amount. It's interesting. I mean, I've been thinking a lot about you know, how to compare these sources, because I mean, you guys have talked about this as well. When you talk about replacing nuclear with renewables, it's kind of an apples and oranges scenario. And I've been trying to find the right sort of metaphors to explain it. And I kind of think about it as like, you know, a freight train versus a whole series of bicycles with little panniers on them. And you're trying to move, you know, this carbon-free energy down the road, right? So that we can decarbonize. And the bicyclists need to take breaks. They need to eat, drink, sleep during the night. And there's no comparison. But, you know, with nuclear, you need to have, you know, this large industry that's going, generally for it to be government supported. And I mean, Indian Point's one of the early casualties, and it's tragic because it's so unnecessary. It's a politically motivated closure. But looking forward to 2050, I was reading an article that was saying there'll probably only be 8 reactors online in 2050 in the entire United States if we don't actually do something about this now. I mean, so the idea of keeping Indian Point going as long as possible and building some new reactors to replace it is not in the cards. It's just really hard to imagine how on earth we're going to achieve any of these ambitious goals by being so counterproductive with the closures. Are you guys aware? I mean, it seems like a lot of this is kind of backdoor, but you know, the fossil fuel, if you kind of like look at the motive and opportunity analysis of a crime and this climate crime, I mean, the fossil fuel interests stand to benefit here. Have you guys been able to investigate that at all? Or has there been anything that's come out in the media in terms of fossil fuel interests supporting actors that are trying to close these nuclear plants? Or is it just, you know, they have kind of useful idiots to do it for them for free in the form of Riverkeeper or NRDC?
We can refer you to people who have a very clear opinion on that, who basically will argue that everybody needs to go to jail because of corruption. However, if there is this kind of corruption in politics, yes, if you would have proof, people would go to jail. Somebody is sitting in jail, Joseph Percoco, one of the closest advisors to the governor. The governor came clean out of this, and Isura mentioned that was really close to Indian Point and the CPV plant in Wawayanda, New York, a 670 megawatt natural gas and oil-fired power plant. As to the political corruption of these organizations, these legacy environmental organizations, there are overlaps, but it doesn't seem to raise the scandal that it deserves. Michael Schoenberg, in his book Apocalypse Never, he put some light on the NRDC and their investments in basically gas power groups. The details here escape me. But it seems something that I, as NRDC, would not put the money in, and they don't seem to have a problem with it. Neither do the members there. So people, yeah, I advise people, go keep looking at that. I think it is the biggest scandal is that they are doing their bidding. And in the end, whether they're doing it out of corruption or out of naivete or stupidity or out of devotion to their legacy network of donors and their audience or something like that, that they have to be anti-nuclear first and everything else second and pay only lip service to this emerging catastrophe of climate change and environmental justice communities. That is the scandal. To put Nuclear New York here into perspective, I just wanted to pitch and explain what we're doing here. Sure, we are environmentalists, basically people who care for the environment and worry deeply about global climate change, also love people. We believe that people deserve to have energy. And this is where we're coming to in Nuclear New York, where we are not necessarily anti-renewable. We look at this part and think, well, the hype is definitely undeserved, but renewable energy has its place, certainly. But we want nuclear energy to have its place too, and to get an opportunity to assist in solving these problems that we're having. Right now, if we wouldn't have intervened at these discussions on the state level to implement the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act of 2019 and said, guys, why don't you mention nuclear? We don't hear it. You got to mention nuclear. It's so important. We're going to fail on the underlying goals of this very important law. We're violating environmental justice communities and we're violating the climate goals by ignoring nuclear, shutting down Indian Point, and we have to worry now about these upstate plans. These plans, they have a planning horizon that is already going past 2029. They need some kind of planning assurance. If we wouldn't have brought this in, they would never have mentioned nuclear at all, despite all the research that they brought in that did mention, well, we need some firm carbon-free source or something. And they also kind of stayed away from it. It was kind of somewhat ridiculous. So we're that home for people here in New York, at least, that are environmentalists and see through all this and find it a shame that nuclear is being cut out just because of these prejudices against it and legacy organizations that always have been fighting nuclear energy. And well, that's, I guess, NRDC still wants to do, despite, I guess, knowing better. If you talk to people at NRDC, they're like, yeah, I don't get it either, but well, I talked to my boss about it.
Right. I mean, it's not unique, obviously, here. Belgium's just permitted, I think, 3 large natural gas plants in their march to phase out 50% of, I think, all of their electricity. And I think it's 80 or 90% of their clean energy, that accelerated phase out, I think, by 2025. So, you know, it's not unique. It's interesting. I mean, up until, I think, the early 2000s are always hard to talk about, but the first decade of the 2000s, a lot of environmental groups were quite openly taking natural gas funding. Again, talking about natural gas as a transition fuel, I think that became untenable given the urgency of the climate crisis and the way that the rhetoric has increased. But I mean, you still have large donors that made their wealth in fossil fuels, like Bloomberg and Steyr, who are funding these groups to a large degree. So it's a bit hard to tease apart. But I mean, let's shift gears a little bit for the final bit of this podcast. Thank you for introducing your group. I wanted to talk a little bit about what happened on May 1st when the plant shut down. I understand there was a gathering in Buchanan, the community where the nuclear plant exists. Can you tell me a little bit about that day? What happened, what it felt like, walk me through that.
I mean, it was described by others as well as a funeral, you know. So I mean, think of Indian Point as being this like core part of New York State energy, but also a core component of Buchanan. I mean, it's 1,000 well-paying union jobs that are now lost. I mean, the gas plants that replace these nuclear plants, I don't remember the number, but maybe it's 50 people.
Mm-hmm. No less, it's even less. It's like a payroll of $3.4 million for the one in Cricket Valley. It's a 1,100 megawatt plant. Wow. Payroll of $3.4 million. Indian Point with 2,000 megawatt nameplate. They had a $140 million payroll.
Yeah.
So it's not only are we destroying the lives of these people, we are also destroying these towns and these communities who are built because of the tax revenue from these plants, from the people who live there and work there and pay their taxes. So city of the village of Buchanan is going to be devastated from this closure. But it's not just there, it's like all the people who, you know, all the people who sold them like flowers or food or, you know, hotels or entertainment or any, all of these things are gonna like go away. The fire department, the police department, the school, I mean, it's and so we mentioned the backroom deal, right? So Buchanan was not consulted at all when Riverkeeper, Entergy, and the state of New York decided by themselves that this plant should be shut. So anyway, it was, when we went up there, it was a very touching moment. We had, you know, folk from around the world come there with us, and we hung 1,000 helmets in honor of the 1,000 jobs that are being lost. And it was a lot. I mean, when you're doing this, you realize like how many lives are we destroying just by this one act. And there was a you know, and everybody was grateful for these workers. The slogan that we went with is nuclear energy workers are climate heroes. I know you guys are doing this in for Pickering as well. And it resonated. I mean, it was very touching. I don't even know how to say.
Yeah. I mean, it is fascinating when you compare, you know, there's so many ways to look at nuclear energy, but when you look at it in terms of, you know, we talked about environmental justice angle with the air pollution issue, but also in terms of the labor issues, that's something that I've been really reflecting on recently. And you're mentioning, you know, we're going from a workforce of 1,000 down to, you know, maybe 20 or 30 for a similarly sized gas plant. And I mean, nuclear is highly skilled people. The costs are highly skilled people and cheap uranium. And gas is, you know, not really expensive gas, but your fuel costs are high and you hardly have to pay anyone to work there. So you're mentioning some of the impacts on the community. I think Buchanan's taxes have had to go up 40% this year in anticipation of the loss of revenue. I was looking at a report that was saying, you know, across the entire U.S., about 10,000 jobs are likely to be impacted or lost as a result of this closure of the single plant. You're mentioning kind of the support workers, but tell me a little bit about this. I'm not sure if it's a community fund that's been set up either by the state or by Entergy, the plant operator, $15 million. I understand that Riverkeeper, who have fought so hard to shut this community, shut this nuclear plant, are maybe going to get all of it or half of it. Can you tell me a little bit about that story?
So when Entergy, when the closure agreement was signed, again, backroom deal between these three people, there was a $15 million set aside. I mean, Entergy has been like the gratitude that the village, the people who worked there towards Entergy was phenomenal. Entergy has been an amazing neighbor and an employer and a good citizen, corporate citizen in their neighborhood. Entergy set aside $15 million to, because they know that everybody will suffer when they leave. They set aside $15 million for the community. Riverkeeper, who were there to write the closure agreement, seems like they've written themselves into that to get a cut from this fund. So the words of
I should have looked it up in the meantime, but it was so softly worded. I mean, you think lawyers do this, right? But that part was just like, oh, Entergy puts away or will spend $15 million on community and environmental causes in the area, right? And then everybody thought, Buchanan is getting that. That's what they thought. And Riverkeeper thought, no, that's what we get. And then we can do some improvements on a river ecosystem or something like that. So this is a sore area of the closure where, we kind of shamed Riverkeeper into going after the money, and they made public statements that they're not taking any of that money, that this money is going to, I guess, Buchanan and the town of Cortland, maybe, or the school district, who are dealing with a severe shortfall in funds.
Yeah, so this, I mean, in May 2020, Paul Galley, the president of Riverkeeper, says, we made no bones about it. We should be happy that the money would be divided 50-50. We've always been well aware of the pressures of Indian Point closure on the local communities. So we've always been open to discussions as to how this environmental and community fund is spent.
Wow.
Can you imagine the mayor of Buchanan reading something like that? She went and ballistic.
She is livid and she doesn't want any of this money going to,
to the people who destroyed her community, right? I mean, the other thing about nuclear is it's these intergenerational jobs that just, you know, in the era of kind of offshore labor just don't exist anymore. We used to have a manufacturing base where, you know, you could work in the same factory your dad worked in, have a good union job and make a decent wage and send your kids to school and they'd get a higher level of education or whatever. But nuclear seems to be one of, you know, these plants last 50, 60, 70, 80, maybe a century. We don't quite know yet. But when I talk to nuclear workers, they're like, you know, the opportunities for advancement and the job security are wild. And I think I saw a statement by the plant nurse was talking about how her son is having to take his family and move away now because of that loss of a job. And so it really, you know, it breaks up the community. I think that's something that's been borne out from the closure of Vermont Yankee and other plants around the states and around the world.
Yeah. Yeah, the irony is that this is being driven by self-proclaimed progressives.
Right.
These are the kind of jobs that Americans are craving for. This is not like a job where you need four off in one family to make ends meet. You need one of them. And then your spouse can take care of the kids and have this American dream kind of thing. That's why the payroll was so high, because the salaries were so high and because the people working there had good lives. They had a super safe job, like nothing happens in these plants. They had their regular hours. Of course, there was shift work involved and qualifications were somewhat high. So these people were well-trained and whatnot, but they took home a salary that would be something that progressives would wish to be able to promise to their voters. And they're kicking it in the garbage. It's really unbelievable.
Yeah.
Under the pretense of protecting New York City. New York City, we're like 30 miles away from this. Nothing would ever happen here with a plan like this. Mm-hmm. This wasn't shameful that it has been trashed so hard.
Let's just close up, guys. I meant to leave more time for this, but we are coming up on the hour. But I wanted to really learn. You're breaking up there a little bit, Azur.
Thing, right? Norris, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to say in sort of closing, I'd meant to leave more time for this, but I really wanted to learn from you guys in terms of some of the actions that you guys took, because I think this is going to be vital in terms of fighting against other threatened closures like Diablo Canyon or Byron or Dresden or Pickering. And so, you know, some of the things that I saw on your social media was this projection campaign. I think I saw also Xeon Lights and Co. had done something similar in the UK, projecting these messages on buildings. I mean, it seems you guys had a pretty decent job getting into the media. I think one of you appeared in a New York Times article, the Sunnyside Post. I just wanted to, and I'm kicking myself for not leaving more time for this, but I wanted to kind of get a few of your takeaways, I guess, in terms of what you learned, what the best strategies and tactics were, so that you know, allies around the world can learn from you guys. Because I think you guys ran a really excellent campaign. I know that the battle was lost, but you know, just from looking at what you guys were up to, very impressive. So yeah, enlighten the listeners.
I think first of all, before we explain our strategies, explain our environment. We are dominated here by the New York Times, at least here in downstate, and the New York Times has been basically ignoring the whole issue. The entire city has been ignoring Indian Point. So for us to get any traction with the downstate media here took a while. The anti-Cuomo oriented papers like New York Post, Daily News a little bit, and local papers up in the Lower Hudson Valley, they kind of followed the story and we got in there. But kind of the breakthrough with TV or with New York Times, that always was very hard for us. So we did a lot of very hard work where we did analysis. We looked at, crunched a lot of numbers. We were faster reports. Eventually happened, their community ignore us, and eventually our data, our facts so strong answered them. Pretty significant. I noticed that when that happened, suddenly we couldn't be ignored anymore, and the strategy to ignore us wouldn't work anymore. So they answered, and in the end, I want Isidore to answer a few questions, a few matters there as well. But in the end, I think what we have achieved, while we failed to prevent the closure of Indian Point, which was like a very high lift late in the game, given all the investments in the gas infrastructure, it's billions of dollars that we would have would have invalidated by this move. But what we achieved, I think, was put to question this for the people and the environment. This kind of claim that people are still trying to make is now being questioned, and they have to justify it, and they fail at that miserably.
I think that's a really good point. I mean, up here in Ontario, about $4 or $5 billion have been spent on gas plants, which are going to replace Pickering, and they already have been built now. And so, you know, when you talk about that kind of inertia, where you know our activism can be effective, there's a window for that, and we're up against major powers at play when we're trying to save a nuclear plant in that context. And I do remember when I was more active, leading the anti-Pickering the battle against the closure of Pickering, I was getting a lot of people on my LinkedIn profile from Enbridge Gas, who are the gas distributor who stands to make, you know, hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars by replacing clean nuclear energy with these gas plants. Unfortunately, you broke up a little bit there, but you were mentioning, I think, just that the you guys did a lot of analytical work and it made it hard for you guys to be ignored in the media. Did you have anything to add in terms of?
Sure. I mean, I think we do a bunch of stuff, right? So we are the research part. I mean, before even Nuclear New York formed, that was a core group of people who had been working together on understanding the energy mix, the changes thereof, and very rigorous. Like, it's not, oh, I feel like solar will replace it. It's like, okay, where is the solar? Where is it going to go? How much is it? So that research, and these are, you know, professors and electrical engineers, people who are not swayed by rhetoric, but by evidence and fact. So that, I think, was a great springboard for Nuclear New York. And then we've been doing a bunch of education stuff. So at Climate Week, we got into, we did a presentation. We've been doing presentations. We are going to do another one at universities. We have been doing more at universities, high schools, et cetera. So that's something that we're doing. And then advocacy work. At these climate discussions, panel discussions, et cetera, that's trying to gauge. We are bringing evidence. We are not saying, oh, I feel like I love nuclear. We are bringing evidence because it seems as if these panels, these discussions seem to be, where's the wind blowing? Or if more people say, yay, wind, then we'll go for wind. I'm like, no, why? If nuclear is not safe, prove that it's not safe. Right. If nuclear is safe, then prove that it's safe and then build it. Like, you can't just go with what feels good, which is what New York State seems to be doing. Mm-hmm. And then activism. So the light show thing was fun to put together. And there's a lot of people. I mean, it's not just Nuclear New York, right? There's folk, you know, Generation Atomic, there's Footprint to Wings, there's many other groups, Climate Coalition, that have assisted us in providing the support to stage these kind of things. We're at this position, but we got this has to be a teachable moment. This has to be, we now have the evidence. It's not like what would happen if a nuclear closes. We know what happens because we show the numbers of fossil combustion going up. Mm-hmm. So it can't, energy efficiency is replacing it. What's the evidence? Look at it. And we have the evidence on our website. We have it on our reports. Let's move forward on a based on reality, not based on what feels good.
And those detailed reports that you guys came up with, I think, were those in response to this physician scientist engineering report, which was claiming that Indian Point, I think they use the language of being offset by renewables and energy efficiency. And whenever I hear the word an offset in the setting of carbon and climate, I'm highly skeptical. It's a big red flag for me. But just very briefly, I'd meant to touch on this earlier. Just tell me about that report. You know, as a founding member of Doctors for Nuclear Energy, it's upsetting that there was a physician group that was a part of advocating for the closure of a zero air pollution source in the context of Asthma Alley. But yeah, just very briefly, what was wrong with their report?
It was wrong. So I think if climate weren't a time-limited challenge, I wouldn't be so angry, active, because every ton of carbon that we put into the air makes it exponentially harder to get it out of the air or to like to solve this problem. So if you have this clean energy infrastructure or non-carbon emitting infrastructure, and you could add more non-carbon emitting infrastructure to it, and you need to do that and displace the fossil combustion so that we can solve this climate issue. But here, it's not that we are displacing fossil, that we are displacing nuclear with renewables, which would mean that you're staying at the same level, which is not what we want, right? We need to get to zero emissions. But here we are actually increasing fossil combustion by 30% for electricity generation. Mm-hmm. So the premise of that, look, the PAC has said that their report was not to advocate for Indian Point's closure. It has been used by Riverkeeper and other groups to pretend as if that's what it says. Mm-hmm. That report says, oh, there will be a little increase in fossil combustion for a little amount of time, but that's not true. I mean, these billion-dollar fossil plants that were built will run for 30 years, and these existing fossil plants either will run at higher capacity for longer or will repower these other plants that are, I was gonna mention these names. So Astoria NRG, Dance Camera, and Gowanus. These are old fossil plants that are proposed to be repowered so they run more efficiently, so that we don't burn in this ramping up and down single cycle, like more polluting plants in Ravenswood or Astoria or elsewhere. Mm-hmm. So this reality is becoming more and more apparent. So yeah. What Cuomo hopes is that this is not public until, you know, he runs, like, until he's out of office. And what Riverkeeper hopes is that this is hidden until they cash that check.
Right.
And
right.
We will make sure that is not the case. That
excellent.
Yeah. There has to be a political cost to destroying clean energy infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a great place to leave it. One thing I saw that I wrote down in my notebook was one of the projections that you guys did was actually on the side of a gas plant. I thought that was really nice to see. Because as much as this community tends to try and be optimistic in the face of the challenges ahead and have a kind of positive solution, it's also very important that we oppose other things. And I thought that was a really poignant use of the technology of that light projection. Guys, it's been great having you on. I want to pick your brain so much more. I guess we'll have to do that offline for our poor listeners because we can't go much more than an hour. But thank you so much for joining me on Decouple and really being here in this difficult and historic week. So thanks again for making the time, guys.
Thank you very much for having us, Chris.
Keep up the good work.
Bye for now. If you enjoyed the podcast, please make sure to subscribe, like, and review us on your podcast platform of choice. Until next time, guys.